Good evening, everybody. Both everybody who's online, as I unfortunately am. I'm really, really sorry that the resolution of the train strike didn't occur in time for me to get myself a reliable train to OSCE. And it's a huge shame for me because this is one of the most important books we've produced at LSE Press. Anyway, let me introduce myself. I'm Pat Dunleavy. I was a professor in the LSE Government Department for a long time. And now I'm Emeritus Professor of Political Science and Public Policy. And wearing my other hat, I'm the Editor-in-Chief of the LSE Press, which, as you probably know by now, is the LSE doing everything that Oxford and Cambridge did 200 and 300 years ago. One day we'll even get a business school. Who knows? You could never tell. So one of my roles in that job as Editor-in-Chief is to help develop the scholarship of young emerging scholars who've got a huge story to tell. And so it was a great blessing for us when we were able to work with Yan Wang and converting her PhD, which she did in the Department of Sociology, into this very impressive book on Chinese pension policy and governmentality in China. And Yan Wang has subsequently, to her PhD, worked in the Department of Methodology and then moved to the School of Public Policy. And in January, very sadly for LSE, she'll be moving to the University of Lancaster to a career track post in lectureship in digital sociology, for which I can think of very few people who are more qualified than she is. Now, her presentation will commence in a minute. I'll say a bit about that, but I should say something also about our two panelists who are in the room. Very sorry not to be with you. So Kerry Freezer is Associate Professor of Sociology is an expert on science and technology studies and situational analysis and medical sciences and well-being and related issues. And Professor Noel Yuchtman is in the Department of Management. He's an expert in managerial economics and strategy, and he's written on a very large range of subjects, including political economy, economic history, human capital, and very importantly for us, the state and economic development. And his many articles include articles in the American Economic Review, the Quarterly Journal of Economics, and the Review of Economic Studies. So we've got very distinguished panelists from sociology and from management or economics to discuss. And they're going to comment after Yan's talk for about 5 or 6 minutes each. So we hope it's not too short. Let me just now introduce Yan's topic, because it is really one of the most important topics and the least well understood topics, I think, in London and Washington and all points west, which is, how does the Chinese state operate? It's a really interesting question, because China has been through some fantastically important and fantastically large scale changes. In the process, the government has had to make some very big alterations in policies that make a great deal of difference to people's economic lives and their whole approach to society and the way in which they look on their participation in society. And Yan introduces here the concept of governmentality, which is a concept that comes from really Foucauldian studies of the state. And emphasizes that the state operates not just in China, but in any setting anywhere in the world. The state operates in multiple diverse ways through many different institutions. And the way in which the state orchestrates and delicately assembles that way of working, that diffused power situation, and in particular, the employment of different kinds of tools such as ideology, information, manipulation, induction of new norms and new values. Those are very important ways in which the state can make changes. And that's particularly the case in very long-run policies that matter a great deal to people, of which pensions policy is one of the most important. And so Yan Wang, in her brilliant book, documents how the Chinese state has, on the one hand, moved to create pensions for very large millions and tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people, and at the same time has had to demobilize previous ways of organizing pensions for industrial workers, particularly the so-called Iron Rice Bowl, and move towards a more of a mixed pension funding system, which is also to some extent a broader system as a result. So this is a story of considerable complexity, and Yang unpicks it with great sophistication. And that's what I'd like her to do now. So I'll just invite her to kick off. Yang.
Great. Thank you, Patrick, for your introduction. And to be fair, you have contained many information I want to introduce myself, but I think your way is better in my way compared to my own introductions. But still, I really appreciate your kindness in introducing the book, especially the context the book lies on the political sociology as well as the China studies. So as Patrick mentioned, this book was developed from my dissertation, and I really appreciate all the efforts done by RC Press and also the my colleague from FPP, if then at the center, as well as the support from my supervisors, Karen Long. And many others like UC. So this book is now open access. Is that because I want to share the knowledge I learned during my PhD process, and also to introduce to academic and non-academic audience more about China. So tonight here, I just wanted to lay out the general context and provide the puzzle of the book, and give a little bit example, substantive example here. So this book is about the story of governance in modern society, with a focus on the state-society interaction using China's case. The context of the story is that we normally would think that rapid economic growth can be a disruptive social process, threatening the social relations and ideologies of the incumbent power. For instance, the modernization theory would argue that a mismatch between social modernization and the institutional modernization would produce some social frustrations and potential instabilities. China's case, for example, the especially after the reform and opening up, this process strongly stimulated the economy and the social modernization in a timescale that has previously taken Western societies centuries to achieve. It gave rise to the urbanization process, the rising level of education, and the expansion of the literacy. Also, there is an increasing demand of political participation. However, the corresponding political institution did not give this kind of adequate channels for the political participation. As shown in the figure, the rapid development of the economy is in sharp contrast to the relatively static nature of its political institutions. Burns and Moore also have this kind of comparative study, raised some similar concerns, drawn from China's urban revolution. According to him, if something happens to threaten and destroy the daily life of most of people, there may be a revolution from the below. However, China's case tells us that the government could actually lead a major social and economic reform over like 40 years without yet encountering some fundamental challenges subverting its rule. So a key question for political sociologists is that how does the logic of the China's government's governmentality being able to help maintain the compliance from the public while acting so radically to promote the economic priorities. So this book actually explores the question from some detailed analysis of the trajectories, the policy rationales, and also the effect of China's pension reforms, trying to demonstrate the statecraft that shapes the ways the citizens perceive the responsibility and benefit allocations between themselves, the state, and the other sectors. So the theoretical inquiry of this book is actually built upon, as Patrick mentioned a little while before, built upon the Weberian and the Gramsci tradition of understanding the state's rule and highlights the individual's rationale of believing and consent. So it also takes account of the Foucauldian governmentality the state uses to maintain its rule and then investigates the underlying rationale. The analytical paradigm of this research actually adopts a holistic viewpoint, integrating both consent-based statecraft and the coercion-based statecraft. So the engine of this interaction between this interactive model is not just the objective economic situation, as in the conventional Winthrop model, but the general design of the ruler, which is constantly updated according to its understanding of the current situation, the public and its own objectives, and or simply as the concept called governmentality. So the upper panel displays the various possible statecraft the state could use in a continuum of hard and soft approaches. In the bottom panel, in the scale of outcomes of the statecraft, public reaction could vary from sincere believers to forced compliance and to even to collective non-compliance, which could be dangerous for the state. So both of the typologies do not exhaust all the possibilities, but act as a guidance for us to see more about the interaction relation between the state and the potential outcome from the public. So the governmentality logic underlines the issue of whom to govern and how to govern. It's shown in the design of the governmental programs. It's also in the way that social problems are defined and the divisions or distinctions are established. Even in the different kind of knowledge produced by the state or the government to shape the people's ideologies. So social welfare provision is one of the most important case that in the political and society change, it can be directly perceived by the individuals. So my empirical work in this book mainly focused on the case of major pension policy changes in China after the 1978 reform and opening up. This area is one that can review the state's purposeful design in modifying the distribution of public goods and balancing the role of the government and the public in welfare provision. Meanwhile, the social policy relating to the old age benefits, it's also an area where many negotiations are possible. So people are less likely to give up their own benefits. Therefore, the government will need more efforts in promoting and persuading people about the reforms they want to achieve. So my investigation on the social welfare is therefore guided by this threat inquiry and the paradigm I discussed before. And this is slightly different from many other works on similar topics, which either simply focus on the descriptive details of changes in policies, or prioritizing the institutional settings of the policies, or take a more simplistic way of treating the welfare policy as purely a tool of surveillance and repression. So in the book, I argue that strategy used by the state to respond to the potential legitimacy crisis and to generate public compliance is hybrid, organic, and dynamic. China's authoritarian governance has been an active process of rule by design, which is constantly adapting to new social and economic situations. On the one hand, the state captures the public expectations and adjusts its own strategies to meet them. On the other, the state intentionally shapes the public expectations and manufacture compliance to keep the reform going. However, the state's well-designed statecraft will need to enable individuals to make sense of their own experiences and must resonate with their common senses, because individuals can update their knowledge from their personal interest, from the information inside the policies, and also from their peers in the society. So they can decide whether they want to stay loyal or choose to choose the non-compliance strategy. And even in a situation where some active rebellion, well, this is called counterconduct, is not that possible, individuals may choose cognitional rebellion and falsify their public compliance. So in the book, I use a combination of various methods, including the institutional analysis and quantitative text analysis to unpack the public knowledge being produced during the reforms. I also use the causal identification to estimate the effect of key policy instruments on public opinion and to see whether people change their perceptions of deservingness, the locus of responsibility, and even political support. In addition to this, actually a heavy part of the book in chapter five actually moves a little bit beyond the pension policy per se, but puts the more focus on the public actively. So I collected the qualitative evidence trying to discuss the issue of why falsified compliance might exist in China and the mechanisms may lie behind it. So here I wanted to give you a little bit more details of the book with one example, the deservingness chapter. So this chapter actually discusses the issue of who deserves benefits and why. So we commonly would think that it is people's social rights to receive public welfare, yet in practice, the policy design of pension is conventionally very fragmented and scattered. So people may have different types of schemes, right? According to their occupations, their age groups. So the different models of pension, actually the policy design adopted by the government actually signals the varied rationales of the their governmentality. So there were two prominent pension models after World War II. One is the World Bank model, and the other one is the international labor organization model. The World Bank model, especially the famed multi-pillar design, is more leaning to the rationale of facilitating economic development and efficiency, while the IO model, which promotes a universal basic pension plan, it's more leaning to a social justice in its design. In 1980s and the 1990s, we have seen a widespread of adoption of the World Bank model in many of our socialist or transitional regimes. And the trade-off between the opportunities and the cost brought by this kind of model is that it provides opportunity for the government to manage the budget and increase the efficiency through privatization and so on. But at the same time, it also raises some issues of legitimacy challenges due to the fact that during the process, many sectors may disappear, and also the allocation of social benefits will face a major reshuffle. So the pension reform in China during that period, we have seen some cutbacks in public spending and many other fiscal rearrangements of the existing welfare programs. And most importantly, there is a reconsideration of social rights for citizenship. So in investigating the governmentality of the pension reforms in this chapter and also in chapter two, I dig into two specific questions. One is how is access to welfare resources distributed among different social groups, and how does the distribution change along different time period? So this question was designed to lay out the general picture of policy design and benefit allocation. And one follow-up question would be, how does the state frame and legitimize its policy changes? Essentially, it's about what kind of truth and knowledge about pension benefits was produced during the process and being promoted by the government in case to promote the new new reforms. So first of all, we can have a quick look into the differentiation of the pension benefit entitlement. In 2015, there were five parallel pension schemes in China for different subpopulations with very different nature and funding resources. For government employees, they enjoy the government funded pension scheme. And for public institutional employees, they used to enjoy the same government funded pension, but it was reformed in 2008 into social insurance, which means the pension contribution responsibility being shared by the government and individual together. And for enterprise employees, their pension plan was enterprise-funded pension. But considering the fact that in before the 1980s, in China, there were mostly state-owned enterprises. So essentially, they are de facto government's ultimate accountability. So in 1980s and the 1990s, their pension scheme were reformed into social insurances, where the funding source, the contribution responsibility being shared by the government, enterprise, and individuals. And for finally, for urban non-salaried residents and rural residents, their accessible pension plan is also social insurance with shared responsibility. So if we look at the longitudinal changes of this pension reforms, it's very easy to identify a desynchronized story. So as we just mentioned, the government employees and the public institution employees will experience a few or non-reforms in their pension plans. But if we look at the pension reforms for enterprise employees, they experienced several waves of reforms in 1980s and the 1990s and into the early 2000s. The reforms corresponding to the economic reforms at the same period. And if we shift our attention to the bottom right, the pension scheme for rural residents and urban non-salaried residents wasn't available until the 2009. So in chapter two, I specifically compared the different schemes using statistical data on some variations such as the participation population, the generosity, and many other variables to talk about the identify the population-based governance. And the basic logic looks like the government would sacrifice the social benefits for employees of the state-owned enterprises, and then the employees of public institutions to reduce the fiscal burden. We're providing some modest or very slender benefits to social groups that could be bought off very easily with the minimal expense. And during the process, the government officials are the core elites of the government power, and they constantly enjoy the most generous social benefits. So now we roughly know who gets what and when, but why? So where is the social legitimacy of such kind of welfare redistribution, right? So commonly agreed among social scientists is that the concept of deservingness refers to certain criteria for judging people, for example, concerning your welfare access and the respective social values of resource distribution. So based on the theoretical understanding, I specifically look into the following aspects of pension benefits in official discourse. The key agendas and the timings, also the fairness, equality, and responsibility allocations. So to give you a better idea of how this kind of social legitimacy and knowledge matters, for instance, in the case of the pension reform for enterprise employees in the late 90s and early 2000s, it was a pay-as-you-go system being turned into a mixed two-tier system comprising social and individual accounts. During the process, the state need to persuade the enterprise employees why they need to take care of themselves and what should they expect from the state. And for the case of pension reform for rural residents in early 1990s and the late 2000s, it was conducted along with the one-child policy, as well as the process of the rapid urbanization, respectively. During the process, the state need to persuade the public why rural residents deserve the expanded pension benefits. So to unpack the question of knowledge construction, I used the combination of machine learning and discourse analysis, and the data source was from the People's Daily. The analytical data is over 3,000 articles containing the keywords of old age insurance and pension in the context from 1978 to 2008. And the specific approaches are threefold. One is unsupervised structured topic model, and the supervised machine learning model, and then the discourse analysis with example documents. So the finger here is actually the identify the topics from this unsupervised structured topic model. It shows the general issues being discussed in the whole document. And we can see that most of them are relatively easy to understand, like the pension fee, old age care, and many others. Also, this kind these different issues are connected to each other. And we can identify several interesting clusters. For instance, the upper cluster here shows a connected topics on retired and pension fee, laid off workers, enterprise employee pension plans. We also can identify here is the topic on birth control connected to rural officials, community care, and family care. So with this identify the topics, we can actually look into the timing of this agenda with respect to the different social and economic reforms at the time. For instance, the finger here shows the proportional change of the topics with respect to the economic reform indicated in the green dashed line, and also the pension reforms for enterprise employees indicated here in the blue dashed line. So the topics of SOE reform and the macro economy, which are shown in the upper two fingers, do present a fluctuation with respect to the economic reform, where the topics on enterprise employee pension reform by year and the lead off workers by year shows the fluctuations following the pension reforms for enterprise employees. So with this general idea of the topics of pension changes, along with different socioeconomic events, we can actually dig into the text and see how does the connections being built up in the text itself. So this one actually is an example on enterprise employees. This topic it presents how it has been connected to the SOE reform. It says the pension insurance for enterprise employees. It's very important for reducing the burden for the burden on the state and on enterprise and advancing the reform of the economic reform, economic system, and guiding domestic consumption in a rational way. Another example shows you the topic on rural pension plan, and here shows the connections between the rural pension plan and the birth control. Essentially, it's the text that describes that the chair of the birth control association visited the villagers and reasoning with them about the cost and benefit of having a second child and the cost and benefit of registering into the pension insurance program. And the end point suggests a fair exchange of registering into the pension scheme for fewer children in rural area. So both of this shows that the pension reform could be used as instrument for the general social economic reform at the time. And in the book, you will find more detailed analysis on redistribution, the politics of redistribution, and also the issue of state and individual relationships use the supervised machine learning model. I hope you enjoy that and leave this to you. To give a very quick wrap up on the topic of determinism is that it shows the logic of the statecraft of China's pension plan is a multi-dimensional. We can see the differentiated benefit entitlement and the different reform paces. We can also see the customized discourse used for different social groups. And most importantly, that is a reconstruction of individual subjectivity, which emphasize the individuals should be involving in the production process as self-motivated, self-regulated, and self-cared. So China's case, of course, is unique in many ways, but as Patrick also mentioned before, it has the potential to address the situations in other contexts and different fields. So especially for the frames and the discourse in the welfare reforms and policy innovations, we always need some careful design and active agenda setting. And the tools and discourse identified in China's case will ultimately help us to explain the society knowledge, how it's emerged and why it's changed, right? Of welfare perception from a broader perspective. And also I hope the substantive evidence in my work using China's case can give some more nuanced approach in understanding the state governmentality and its design. And in the book, I also have chapters talking about whether the efforts brought by the government using propaganda and using the policy experiments really changed the public opinion and why people changed or not changed in their perception of welfare responsibility, and also a large load of discussion on the how people perceive the legitimacy of the government in their daily life, and also the mundane forms of congregational rebellion, how is that possible in the society. And I hope you will enjoy the reading the book. That's all for now today, and I look forward for any comments and feedback from you. Thank you. Patrick, you are muted.
Thanks very much, Jan. That was a very masterful account. It's enormously difficult to capture the richness and the density of the many different findings and aspects of how Chinese multidimensional statecraft works that are in the book. And I do urge everybody to download their copy of the book and study it carefully. But now let's move on to our discussants. I'll start with Carrie Frieser. Would you like to go first and give us your views?
Yeah, we thought it would be nice for Noam to go first. And I'll go.
Okay, all right. Noam, you go first.
One more piece of instruction from you. Should I sit here or should I go to the lecture?
It's entirely up to you.
Okay, I'll stay here.
You can hear you just as well.
No, thanks so much for inviting me to participate. I mean, it's obviously a huge source of joy to see a student produce a book, and especially such a great book. So congratulations, Jan. It's a really important piece of work. I think it's important across the social sciences. I'll offer, you know, my economist take and see what people think, see what you guys think. But what seems, you know, to me, and let me say, the economist take is necessarily a bit general. So I want to zoom out from the specific case of China and pension policy to think a little bit about, you know, what do we learn about the way politics works? And one, you know, maybe the first thing I learned from talking to Yan and then reading the book is that we need to think about the full distribution of citizen attitudes, not just in democracies, but also in autocracies. So sometimes we think, you know, in a democracy, the regime has to be responsive to voters. The ruling party wants to perform well to get reelected. And then we might think about autocracies as caring only about performing well enough to avoid insurrection. And I think Yan's work suggests that actually being a successful autocracy like China requires engaging with the full distribution and you know, trying to generate sort of what the regime would think of as you know, sort of better outcomes across the distribution. And that might mean at one end of the distribution, actually generating active support that can be very useful. At the other end of the distribution, of course, an autocracy cares about social unrest and concerns about you know, political instability and potential upheaval. But I think engaging with the full distribution is to me at the heart of this work. You know, then the question is, well, how does an autocracy do that? And of course, Yan studies a particular case of pension policies, but I think we can generalize to think about different technologies of engaging with you know, a group of citizens under autocracy. And one is trying to provide material benefits. Another is to try to persuade citizens to support you, or maybe if not support you, at least comply. And the third, of course, is coercion. And we can see autocracies and the Chinese Communist Party doing, you know, using all of these technologies, acting on different parts of the distribution in different ways, at different times and in different places. And I think that's incredibly important when we look around the world today. And it's not obvious how an autocracy, and the Chinese autocracy in particular, will do that. So when you think about, you know, Hong Kong's civil unrest over the past 5 to 10 years, and, you know, one might have thought that the way to engage with Hong Kong citizenry would be to, you know, gradually expand democratic rights, and that would move people, you know, toward much more compliance and maybe even support for the autocracy's representatives in Hong Kong. Instead, China went in a completely different way and decided to crack down on, you know, the group of individuals who were least compliant initially, least supportive initially, and to focus much more on coercion on that part of the citizenry, which, you know, to be fair and to be honest, as much as that upsets me, in another part of the citizenry, that crackdown increased the Chinese government's legitimacy and support by generating more stability and predictability. And so the Chinese government was weighing these different parts of the distribution, evaluating the different technologies at its disposal, and decided on crackdown on one segment in return for you know, pure compliance and certainly not support. In the other part of the distribution, perhaps more support and at the very least compliance. And I think, you know, that's very interesting. You know, looking ahead, one, you know, wonders what technologies China might try to use in Taiwan if it were to try to induce, you know, governmentality there, you know, if it happens. No more comment on that. You know, looking across history, we also see interesting variation. You know, and I think, again, it's not obvious the way history will work. So when I think when the Chinese Communist Party took over, it was able to generate actually a great deal of support and legitimacy through ideology. So revolutionary parties that win revolutionary wars have an enormous amount of support and legitimacy in many places. And I think China is one of those places. And so the Chinese, you know, it was an autocracy, but an autocracy with a huge amount of support through ideology. Then it abandoned its ideology after these 1979 reforms and relied much more on performance as a source of legitimacy and, again, support. And I think there was a great deal of support post-79 on the basis of performance. Now, more recently, performance for a variety of reasons has worsened. I mean, you know, and for reasons within the party's control and external. And then one wonders what happens next. And you can see Xi Jinping turning again toward ideology as a source of legitimacy in the absence of performance. And we'll see how well that works. But I think it's interesting that you know, old technologies, you know, can be brought back. Looking ahead, I think there are two interesting, you know, questions. One is, what will be the role of technology in shaping, you know, technological change and shaping which, you know, sort of technologies of compliance the Chinese government is able to use. You know, I think the obvious, you know, dimension of technological change to think about is artificial intelligence and the use of AI to try to align behavior of the population with the objectives of the Chinese regime. We've all read enough dystopian novels and sociology to know that there could be this sort of alignment that might reduce the need for coercion. And so I think there is reason to believe that the Chinese government could sort of maintain a great deal of stability and, you know, somewhere between compliance and support arising from the right use of AI and AI-induced incentives, along with rich data collection and monitoring, to reduce the need for active coercion. And I think that's something that either we applaud because there will be less coercion, or we fear it because there's a different sort of, you know, technology that limits our freedom in some sense. But I think that's an interesting, you know, an interesting question for the future. The last one that I think, you know, remains to be seen is this question of you know, what does the Communist Party's legitimacy depend on in terms of performance and ideology? And I think, you know, for a long time, you know, there's been a rise in nationalism in China. And nationalism is a sort of ideology that is a little bit like religion in that it's unfalsifiable. So Xi Jinping can claim to be the true representative of the Chinese people. And that's something that it's hard to you know, like objectively evaluate. Whereas success fighting against COVID, success in bringing Taiwan back into the motherland are sort of objective evaluation criteria that in some ways are a bit, you know, scarier in a way. They're higher stakes, you know, claims or standards for legitimacy. And I think, you know, I wonder, you know, what other people and Yan maybe in particular sort of think about a shift toward more objective standards for establishing legitimacy and success. And you know, whether that is going to be effective, was that, you know, sort of an act of desperation? Is that something that we should be afraid of looking ahead? But I think it's a fascinating book. Obviously, it opens up huge questions. Thanks.
So thanks very much, Noam. Very broad-ranging and reflective comments. Yes. Carrie, do you want to say something?
Yes, thank you. First of all, I want to just repeat what Noam has already said and just say a big congratulations to you, Yan, on this incredibly impressive book. To be able to celebrate Yan's success as a PhD student and now her success in publishing this academic piece of work as a book it's just an honor. This is a proud moment and it's really just a happy celebration. And so we're very proud of you, and you should be very proud of yourself. So I should start by saying that I came to Yan's project without expertise in China or in pensions, but rather through our shared interest in governmentality as a concept. And as a medical sociologist, I have long cared about pensions because I've long cared about old age and later life. And so these shared interests is what has brought us together. And this is where I'm coming from. And I think it's really important to probably emphasize that the ways in which you have juxtaposed different theories of state power, including Weberian approaches, Gramsci and Marx, along with Foucault, it is really impressive. And these are theoretical ways of thinking about state power that are often held apart. So I just want to really emphasize the creative theoretical work that you're doing. And to second what Nova's been saying in maybe more theoretical terms, we often think of governmentality as something that goes hand in hand with liberal democracies. And that this idea of technologies of self, of cultivating certain kinds of subjectivities is somehow antithetical to autocracy. And what your research shows is this is a false kind of divide. And I think you do a lot of really important work in showing how the Chinese government creates these new subjectivities. And how this there's a subjectification around being self-motivated, self-regulated, and self-sufficient as technologies of self, as shifting the discursive terrain on which people come to understand themselves and the kinds of people they can become. So I think that this is a really important theoretical intervention that you make in this book and that you make in your PhD. In many ways, my notes maybe pick up on this intervention that you're making and propose possibly other ways of developing this conceptual work. Maybe not necessarily by you, but you maybe by people in the room, or you know, I think there's a lot of research that can now be done with this groundwork that you've laid out. And I think that there's a lot of implications for your research in terms of how we think about governmentality. And particularly when we start to think about AI, as you say, which is shaping the kinds of information that people use in constructing a self. And I think in this sense, what you lay out is really the language side of discourse and how that's used. And I think what you open up is the opportunity now to extend out those discursive practices and the different ways in which that those practices come to operate. So I was thinking in reading your book, so for Foucault, in developing governmentality as a concept, things like psychiatry as an expert set of knowledge practices, or the hospital as a way of transferring health, illness, and death from the home to these new expert regimes was a crucial way in which governmentality was operationalized in the European context, so that science as a site of knowledge production, but also medicine became appendages of the state. And so the politics with the capital P didn't need to do so much coercive work in order to get people to want to do these things. And I think that your research shows how the news media, which is clear, but is one such appendage. But the policy experiment is another appendage. And I think that's what I found really fascinating about the ways in which the policy experiment is this place for doing governmentality. And I was wondering, what are there other kinds of new actors involved in these policy experiments who are reshaping old age in China during this time? And I just wondered, could there be a kind of third dimension to that mapping? So I was asking myself, you know, does a discipline like gerontology play a role in the policy experiments in China or not? And if not, who does? And so probably because I'm a medical sociologist, I just became really interested in figure 3.3 and the status of old age care and community care. And I really love how you show how community care and the one child policy becomes this way of convincing people to take this on. But I was wondering, are there any other corollary developments in the institutions that facilitate home-based elder care, for example? Like, what practices need to come into play? And it's just what, in terms of what work needs to be done to make the discourse of piety, so this, the hearkening back to these traditional references, to what makes them work in these new moments? What practices need to be there or don't? And to what extent is there maybe a desire to reimagine filial piety that is being tapped into or not? And I think, as you say, that the AI question is crucial in all of this, because I think artificial, combined with digital technologies, and you will know lots better than anyone else, is shaping what information we can have and how people construct that means of themselves. So I think there's so much work to be done from this fabulously rich book. So thank you and congratulations.
Stimulating remarks. Now, we're in the portion of the event where we'd really like to get some questions from the floor, from people in the room. And I think there are some microphones either working or someone will circulate around. Meanwhile, also people online, let's get some questions in from you guys. We'd really encourage you to put your questions into the chat and we'll relay. But let's go to questions in the room.
As you know, in many countries, the pension funds are in crisis because they are managed as private enterprises. It is because of the rising life expectancy that makes the difference between the fraction of those who receive pensions and those who produce wealth, is this gap is increasing. My question is how China has coped with this problem. Thanks.
Are we collecting more questions or are we answering one by one?
Right.
Okay. So of course it's a common issue for the pension to get in trouble. And also according to the development of the demographic features of the society, there will be a extended demand from the pension system. I think in China's case, as I mentioned, there have been reforms in the early 2000s and in 2010s. In the different period, actually see different designs of the pension reforms. As I said, for different social groups, there will be different schemes for them. In addition to the pillared pension scheme, we also saw there is a state-funded basic pension to get this kind of basic social net, safety net for everyone in the society. So that's one way the government is doing, especially in entering the 2010s. We can see an expansion of this kind of safety net for everyone to be included in the basic pension support from the government. Even though it's like a minimum support, but it can also be a combination of this kind of social justice and the efficiency combined together in the policy design. So I think China's case is may not be replicable for all other countries, but at least it can give some basic ideas of how basic pension plan and the pillared pension schemes can be combined for varied social groups.
Good. Any other questions?
Yes. Dr. Wang, thank you very much for your book and your shares about China's pension policy, and also you like share the world how China managed the pension policies through decades. So my question is, I would like to know your own opinion. Do you think there will be a bureaucratic drift in the pension policy in China? Because we know we have a new leadership panel this year, and we knew what happened in Shanghai, this strict COVID policy. So, and you also mentioned you use a lot of political science theories and you used quantitative methods to analyze those situations. But I'm keen to know from your perspective, what will be the future like? Will you consider it a principal agent problem when the Chinese government to make the pension policy? Because you also mentioned about public goods, which means if the government officials, they make the pension policy, they will they probably will to make the policy be favorable for the public servant. Yes, thank you.
Right, that's a very interesting question. Actually, it's also related to Carrie's question on is there new actors in policy experiment in China's case? Actually, it is important to think about the principal agents question in governing or governance issues in general. And in my the model I showed you before, it was a two-actor model, right? The state and the public, or individuals, the interaction between them. There is this kind of actor in between, which is the bureaucrats. They can have more information of their own performances and also their own willingness of adapting new ideas of policy reforms. And the pension system, as I mentioned, there is a great deal of negotiations happened. And one of the negotiation type is actually the policy experiment, which have a great silent of the local bureaucrats, whether they wanted to be a pilot region in the experiment initiated by the central government, or they can also initiate the experiment by themselves. So the local governments, their willingness and also their ideas on redistribution, also their education or gender or their age will be factors affecting whether this region received more on the pension reforms or reform the schemes or not. So that's why actual actor really causes this kind of variations across different regions. It's not entirely covered in this book's discussion, but it's surely an important question to answer in the future if we wanted to think about the variations across different regions and also the roles local bureaucrats played in the process. And in the future, I don't know what the future will be like, because the agency of the local bureaucrats definitely will shape the grown landscape of governance in China. And even though the central government has much control over the personnel, over the promotions, we still can see the activity promoted or initiated by the local government or local officials. So I would encourage people to think more about that. One thing related is the technocrats. We always think during the process, because in the new government formed during the 20th Party Congress, we can see more technocrats were included in the top leadership. So of course following Xi's leadership, but it's whether that's going to change China's governance and also the scenario of especially public goods redistribution is something we can think about in the future research, I think.
I guess I have one comment and one quick question. And firstly, congratulations. And as the social policy researcher, really thank you for contributing this really great work to welfare politics in China. I think currently the influential work on welfare politics in China concentrate in the area of understanding the political will of the very top leaders or, well, let's say principal agent, you know, view, but it's sort of limited to the state sector, like the bureaucratic politics, whereas not least because the area space between state and society is very difficult to research. However, your work really geniusly use machine learning plus discourse analysis to really capture public opinion and, you know, the dynamics there. So my question is, where will this success lead to the next success? We really were very interested in, you know, what this work has inspired you to work on next and where your next monography might come from. And if you don't mind to share.
Right. Thank you. A quick answer for your question is that surely I haven't had a very firm idea on what my next question is going to be, but it will be related to the public opinion and also the state-society relationship, especially on the issue of social cleavage. We have seen, especially after the COVID-19, we have seen the divisions in the society regarding many issues, for example, the COVID policy, and also on the nationalism ideologies, right? There is a huge divisions among the society itself. And how do we understand the landscape of that division, as well as the role brought by the state itself, is something I wanted to explore in the future. If I got extra time and energy, I probably will dig into more on the bureaucrats agency as well. But that's something in the design not settled yet. Thanks for that. Another question from.
Congratulations on the book. My question is that when designing pension policy, the government inevitably looks for to other countries for experience. And when they manufacture the knowledge to justify the reforms or whatever, they sometimes would run into this constraint. I extol the virtues of the GPS system to persuade the citizenry, but you can see that how that can somehow undermine the justification for the socialist aspect of the society. I am wondering, you know, in making practical policy, how does government make the trade-off in those two constraints?
Yeah. Okay, thanks for that. Surely it's a trade-off between the opportunities brought by the experiences by the other countries and also the cost of persuading the society. I think they are, if we think about this data as a actor who is actively adapting to the new social and economic situations, the strategies they use can be a multi-dimensional. It's not just a one source of argument they would borrow. And also, as we all know, the state itself is not one entity, right? When we look into the details of the persuasions or the interaction with the society, you can see many different strains of arguments. They can borrow from the traditional ideology and like the traditional culture, or they can borrow from the foreign experiences which is called advanced experiences from the other countries, or they can borrow from the socialist period about the fairness of redistribution. And I think it's really interesting to see the nuance inside this kind of interaction. rather than to just simplify the argument as one strategy. And I would think it as a more dynamic one, especially considering if you see the flow of time in different or geopolitical scenarios, you will see different strategies, whether they would borrow more from the nationalism ideology or from an advanced international idea. It actually depends on the temporary scenario they are facing. So yeah, I think that's something I learned from the materials I did in the past.
Thank you. I've just started my kind of journey, so forgive me if my question is a bit nuanced. I'm new to this whole thing, probably this group. But my question is, with this whole COVID-19 pandemic, with all these recent events, Russia, Ukraine, the governments have seen that they obviously have had to exercise a whole new degree of power, and they've in a way that's never been seen before. Do you think this will? Do you think the potential of the government to change their perspectives to their pension policy and their treatment towards these certain these populations that you're talking about? Do you think that's likely to change in the near future, or do you think it's going to remain relatively stable with the whole AI thing?
Yeah, thanks for that. I think it's also related to Norman and the current comment on the AI and technologies being used in the current situation, as well as the potentials brought by the COVID-19 crisis. I'm not entirely sure about whether that's going to be more stable or going to be new changes, but surely the technology will bring new possibilities for the government to manage. For example, the information will be easier to manage for the government from the individual level. And then the pension system, especially regarding the redistribution, it might be possible that for some sectors, they will see a reshuffle of social rights. And for some social groups, they will see an increase of their benefits. It's really something interesting to investigate in the future, I think.
I'm acutely conscious that everybody in the room who's there can very soon adjourn to get some drink. So perhaps we could have one more question. And if there isn't that one question, perhaps we could move to close the session and you could all migrate to the drinks. And I will migrate to my lonely glass of Prosecco or whatever it is. any last question that anybody would like to ask?
I have a really quick one. What is bureaucratic agency?
Right. So yeah, that's actually something related to it can be unpacked in several ways. One is their abilities, and then their willingness. And finally, what they are doing. So basically it's whether the bureaucrats have the preferences or incentives to increase or decrease the redistribution of public goods in the case of pension reforms, and also whether they prefer the social justice or the efficiency of the economic development. So it's essentially about the local bureaucrats' involvement in the political decision-making or the policy making process. They would bring their own ideas, right, in the process. So that's how the agencies, to be honest.
Good, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. It remains to me really to wrap things up and to say First of all, many thanks to Noam and Carrie for your very interesting and wide-ranging comments. And particular congratulations again to Jan on a very brilliant piece of work and a very interesting presentation, which will soon be available from LSE recording and so forth. And I'm sure we'll have a big effect in publicizing the book. In the meantime, if you haven't got your copy of the book, do make sure that you download it, and let's get the momentum started for it. I'm sure it's going to be a huge success. So it remains to me to thank everybody for coming, thank everybody online. We've been very grateful for the participants who were like me coming in over Zoom, and thank everybody in the room. Thank you for your very interesting questions, and please do now adjourn in the room and get yourself some refreshment. Thank you very much.